Well, I think I'll get started. First thing I'll do is I'll introduce myself. I'm Mark Asquith. I'm a longtime comic book fan and used to manage the Silver Snail. I was a consultant for a movie called Comic Book Confidential, which won the Genie, the Canadian Oscar. I then created a TV show called Prisoners of Gravity, which was 5 years with the host Rick Green. Rick Green is famous, I am not. And then I was the showrunner of Imprint, a show about books. And then 22 years ago, became the founding producer of Space, Canada's national science fiction channel. And that ended in May when I retired. So I'm now...
I should be interviewing you.
And our guest today is Denny O'Neill, who I've interviewed a couple of times. And to say comic book legend is an understatement. He is probably best known for his work on Batman as an editor and a writer. He also worked on one of the great breakthrough books, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, which garnered more publicity at the time than almost any other comic book had. So, ladies and gentlemen, Denny O'Neill. What? Microphone closer? To you.
Yeah. How's that? Is CX4 calling control tower? That's from a radio show called Hop Harrigan that I listened to when I was 5.
So I want to start, you started as a journalist. How did you get from journalism into comics?
By accident. I was one of two liberals in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and I didn't know anybody, so I hung out at drugstores and newsstands, and I suddenly was aware that I was seeing comics, and though they were an enormous part of my childhood, I hadn't seen them for about 10 years. So I investigated a little bit. I had a hunch that something was happening, and it was. At one end of Manhattan Island, there was Julie Schwartz figuring out how to do the superhero stuff contemporary. And across the island, there was Smilin' Stan Lee with a unique approach to writing dialogue and plotting and getting the work done. So I did some stories on comics are making a return. They had been eclipsed for 10 years because of a witch hunt. That was a time in America when conformity was considered a virtue. And I grew up in Catholic school, so... Anyway, Roy Thomas's parents subscribed to the paper, and Roy saw these stories, so... Driving back from St. Louis one Sunday afternoon, I decided I would... This school teacher, Roy Thomas, I'd stop in and see him. And I got... For 2 hours, he opened the world. There was this whole intricate subculture I had never heard of, even though as a kid, I read lots and lots of comics. We traded them. I'd do once a month. I would load up my little American Flyer wagon and go up and down Claxton Avenue, stopping at the houses of the kids I knew who were comic book readers, and we would trade. So my father was buying me one comic book a month, or a week. After Sunday Mass, we would stop, and he would get a quart of milk for the family and a comic book for me. But I would get, with the trading gimmick, I'd get 20 new stories to read that way. And I don't remember the relationship I had with school. I have a hunch that I was finding Superman and Batman a lot more interesting than Dick and Jane and the damn ball that they were always chasing. I have a fairly severe case of ADD, and I question that I've ever learned anything in a classroom. I was from childhood on a constant reader, though I didn't come from a literary family. But I've always been interested in finding things out. And if you have ADD, it is torture to sit through an hour and a half of a guy who the teacher probably doesn't want to be there. I married eventually the best teacher I've ever known. She loved kids. That's the secret of teaching grade school. Love children, and she did. My son is a college professor, and I occasionally teach at New York University. And if you're teaching at that level, you've got to love the subject. You don't even have to know the names of the kids, but you have to really be interested in what you're doing.
Well, what about comics interested you? Why? And you've devoted over a five-decade career to comics. What is it about comics that you love as an art form?
I sometimes think it's genetic. I have known people, I was married to one, who could not like comics. Annie wanted to like comics. And she liked the people I was, bringing home. But she couldn't, and she was an avid reader and a science fiction fan. But she could not wrap her head around. Here's what comics are. It's a language. It is a language in which an image and an abstraction, words, combine to help each other out in the way a noun and a verb cooperate to make an English sentence. And there's something about the language. I just loved it from age four on. And other people, like the guy who reads the most novels I know, Paul Kupferberg, can't read poetry. Just does not respond to it. I don't know why this is. I know that I have been a storyteller since age seven, and the people who last at this job are the ones who would be doing it if they weren't getting paid. They have a kind of need to tell stories. And the ones, some of you may qualify for this insult I'm about to deliver, who want to be part of the comic book scene, well, yeah, there's a lot of conventions to go to. But they don't tend to be good at the job. They don't tend to be really interested in this thing. You have to be not only willing but eager to close the door behind you for, in my case, 20 to 40 hours a week and be alone with a computer and your head. And once upon a time, it wasn't a computer. It was a piece of typing paper. But Harlan Ellison is one of the best writers of the 20th century, and he ran into a wall. Harlan just died. He was a friend of mine, and last year was horrible for people not surviving. But he found that he could hold an audience brilliantly. And he once admitted that I have stiffed every editor on both coasts. Nobody trusts me anymore. I stayed with him once when I was doing a show for CBS, and I watched. He had a deal with NBC where he was going to have the Harlan Ellison science fiction show. They needed an act by Thursday. He could not make himself sit down to write 20 pages of dialogue. And, of course, the show never happened.
Well, how do you keep yourself? Because, you're so prolific. How do you keep yourself going? He was amazing.
Well, I'm not as prolific as, the guy who wrote The Shadow for the Pulps.
Walter Gibson.
Walter Gibson, yeah. Find me a magician. When I met him, he did a contorted and restored napkin. That's how he introduced himself. First of all, you have to want to do it, as I said. There are people who can't stand the idea of being alone like that. Harlan got so he showed off after a while. He would be writing a story in the middle of a party of 100 noisy people. And he, you know, obviously that was his engagement party. There were a lot of writers there. And he, hey, Denny, how would you describe a man with long red hair? And, you know, he was like picking people out that he knew were writers. Well, that's a fine thing to do as a party stunt. It ain't writing. He also, on that same visit, went on the Today Show, had one of their performers suggest a story theme, and then for the rest of the day, he was in a store window on 5th Avenue and 53rd Street writing that story. Well, that's cute, and he also did a similar thing in L.A., but it has nothing to do with storytelling. There are a lot of people now who don't do the basics. I disagreed with Jim Sugar about almost every... Well, I agreed with him in principle, but in the way we implemented this stuff, no. Dead disagreement. But he said you have to establish conflict by page 3. That's a draconian pronouncement. Don't generalize like that, but in principle he was right. You can read 3 issues of a story and not know the name of the villain. You have to establish things. Julie Schwartz made me do In Brightest Day and Blackest Night, No Evil Shall Escape My Sight, Those Who Worship Evils Might Beware My Power, Green Lantern's Light. I had to do that once an issue, and I kind of resented it. And he was right, because that was a little touchstone for the readers, and it was like a drum roll. It told the readers something interesting is now going to happen.
Well, you mentioned Green Lantern, Green Arrow. That was one of the very first comics to really deal in a substantive way with social issues. And you mentioned earlier that you were a liberal. Was that, you're all for that water for you. Was that something really important to you? You wanted to use comics to educate people about certain issues?
Yeah, I was the real deal. I went into the Navy believing everything I had been told by authority figures. God help me and forgive me. If we didn't stop them commies over in Asia, they was going to be eating off mama's silverware. And as I said, it was a time of conformity. By the time I got out of the Navy, I had met a lot of peaceniks. What they were saying was making sense. And I later found out that only 2 journalists that were covering the Vietnam War actually covered it, actually left the damn hotel and went out where they could have been shot. Dave Halberstam of the Times was one, and a guy whose name I'm not remembering who worked for Time was the other. And they were rewritten when the copy went to New York. But I was convinced that the peaceniks were right. I created a character based on the woman who was the country's leading radical at the time. The character is on television every week. It's played by one of the most attractive actresses in Hollywood, Leslie Tompkins, who chose to stay in the ghetto. Well, that's what Dorothy did. My Leslie was a doctor, and the real Dorothy was a journalist. I have a collection of stuff she wrote when she was a teenager, and she was the archetypical Greenwich Village chick. She was by reputation able to drink Eugene O'Neill under the table. She wrote a book called The Seventh Virgin in 1937 that was considered smutty at the time. What she did in Lower New York, where I was first married, was she fed the hungry, she clothed the naked, and she gave shelter to the homeless. That's what she did, and she did it every day. And she was constantly in trouble with the church authorities. The other thing, but like my Catholic parents and family could understand feeding the hungry. Priests didn't much do it, but Dorothy's lay people did. She is now up for sainthood, and I got interviewed by the Archdiocese a couple of weeks ago, and I told the clergyman who was interviewing me, you know that Dorothy told her daughter, don't let them make a saint of me, because saints you can dismiss. That will pull my fangs. So I mentioned this to the guy who was interviewing me, and he said, yeah, we know that. But if she becomes a saint, every school, Catholic school kid in the country will know who she is. He was right. So there are now, the place that she started at on Christie Street in the village, East Village, is still going, and I'm told there are 100 other Catholic worker installations. My best friend, who died within 24 hours of my wife dying, God was really mad at me that weekend, but he cooked. He was retired, and he cooked once a week for, he lived in San Francisco for the Northern California people. I don't believe in an afterlife, and I was explaining that to somebody I was having lunch with, and then I fell off, and this was an old friend who, and she thought I was being cute. I was, being funny, and then she said, after 2 minutes, I looked, and you were turning green. I was dead. And she yelled, the guy who owned the restaurant knew that the city, the town, it's Piermont, New York, had bought a defibrillator, and it was next door. And he was a fireman. So on 3 tries, I got my heart beating. And
well, welcome back. We're all glad you made it then. Tell me, those Green Lantern, Green Arrow stories were drawn by Neil Adams, well known to people in this audience. What was it like collaborating with Neil Adams?
Have you ever done self-dentistry? I wish Neil well. I want him to live long and prosper, and I'm saying that very seriously. But wow, he is like Shooter, and Shooter is like President Trump. They are narcissistic. They cannot admit they are wrong. None of those three people has ever admitted they were wrong. There was photographs of an empty mall, and Trump was saying there was a record turnout. And you could see that he was lying, and he has to this day not admitted that he was wrong. I've had...
In fact, he said that photograph was taken before the crowd showed up. It was taken early in the morning.
And he, according to the LA Times, has told 5,000 lies since he's been in office. He started telling lies. I mean, we shouldn't have been surprised. He did what he said in his campaigns he was going to do, and had nothing to do. I mean, it's a broken system. I know a couple of senators, and they have to spend 30 hours a week fundraising. Okay, the economy is a very complicated subject. Where are you going to find time to learn about the economy if you're spending all that time on the phone begging for money?
Well, let's get this back to Neil. So why is working with Neil so difficult? Why is it like self-dentistry?
He never met a deadline, though he will tell you that he never missed one. And twice he rewrote my copy, and one of the rewrites I find deeply offensive as a human being and a husband and a father and all that stuff that we are if we're alive. It was the drug story. Neil has complained that I've complained about this. He didn't think I had any right to be offended. The last panel, Speedy and Green Arrow are facing each other over the corpse of a kid who has died of drug problems. Speedy punches Green Arrow, and Green Arrow, picking himself up off the floor, says, "Ah, the kid's himself again." So the subtext of that is a punch in the face will solve a drug problem. That is pernicious and ugly and stupid. And had I known that that was going to be the rewrite, I would have insisted on taking my name off. I signed papers, we all did. They had a right to do anything they wanted. But the editor had that right, not necessarily the artist. But I'm not a diva. Okay, put on whatever you want. But when I've worked in television, I've been given the opportunity to read the script they're going to shoot from and to take my name off of it. That's the TV Writers Union is a great union. It really enforces that stuff. So I just didn't want to be associated with that mindset that a punch will solve any problem. It now bothers me once in a while that I write so many stories about violence. And often, I mean, I just finished a sequel to There Is No Hope But in Crime Alley that introduced Leslie Tompkins. And when I wrote that 40 years ago, comic books, I mean, we had a lot of no-nos. I got to actually write the story this time, and I had the Dorothy Day character say to Bruce Wayne, Bruce Wayne almost punches an 11-year-old, and she gets in the way and says, "You're a hypocrite, you're a liar, you love violence, you solve everything with violence. You are kidding yourself, and you're kidding me, and you're kidding the world. You don't have to do what you do. There's plenty of other things you could do to help the world. But no, you insist on hitting people." And now the parameters of writing comics have loosened to the point where you could have a sympathetic character say, "No, Batman is really not a healthy guy." In my own conception of him, yeah, he's... there's a part of him that really likes it. And here's the private biography of Batman. He is now 33, as I was raised a Catholic, and that's when Christ got... What? The priests and nuns, if they get you when you're seven, they got you for life. So, anyway, how did I get off on that?
It's okay. The Jesuits have that saying, "Give me a child until they are seven, and I will give you the man." So I know that one. But what is it about Batman that fascinates you? You've edited him, you've written him, you've worked on him for decades.
Well, a practical professional writer in me realized early on that he is a great storytelling tool. Here are the limits I gave my writers. He does not have a love life, and he does not kill. And I have made up reasons for that. Anything else, and no science fiction of the kind that the character did in the 50s. I think of it as science fiction light. It's funny little aliens who come down and do funny little things.
And how important was the detective aspect to you, the solving of the crime?
Well, Julie insisted that we were doing detective story. We did one detective story. I have at this point written maybe two 200 to 300 Batman stories. One of the things I'm proudest of is a story that actually was a detective story. You, the reader, could figure out who the murderer was before Batman if you paid attention to the art. And Neil did a great job. If you looked at how tall... the situation is a circus sideshow is trapped on a mountain by a storm. One of them is a murderer. Batman is trapped with them. And he, figures out who it is eventually. Julie liked things like Ellery Queen's mystery stories, which were played almost as puzzles. There would often be a paragraph in the middle of an Ellery Queen story that said, well, Ellery now knows who the killer is, and he may be ahead of you, but it'd be a good idea if you remembered that the murder happened in a greenhouse with a toothpick. And if you know that, then you actually could figure it out. So I was proud of that as a piece of craftsmanship. You cannot, because of the limitations of the medium, you can't put a lot of red herrings in a comic book story, as happened in, the classic Agatha Christie kind of stories. There is a brilliant essay, and everybody in this room should read it. It is the one required reading that I have when I teach. It is called The Simple Art of Murder by Raymond Chandler, published in 1945. And it is ostensibly a comparison of the kind of detective story Dashiell Hammett was writing and the kind that Agatha Christie was writing. For Agatha Christie, it was always in a little country house, and there were lords and ladies, and it was a very, very genteel murder. And it was so far away from real life, it was laughable. If you like solving puzzles, you can read those. If you read Chandler and Hammett, you read tough blue-collar guys who get pissed off and decide somebody's not going to get away with murder. And then with Chandler, you had his brilliant use of language.
It was interesting you bring up Chandler, because one of the young storytellers that came to Marvel Comics didn't get much of a career early on in his career at DC or Gold Key, so he went to Marvel, was someone you mentored, Frank Miller. Do you have any memories of early Frank Miller and what you taught him while he was doing Daredevil?
Sure. There were volleyball games in Central Park every Sunday afternoon with the comic book community. I was possibly the worst volleyball player in history. But I was there when there was this kid from...
Vermont,
somewhere in New England. And he was a good volleyball player, but walking out to the subway, he would ask me the most intelligent questions about my own stories. I almost never got intelligent questions. But then I wrote a book about the history of comics for Scholastic, and that led to me interviewing Jim Shooter and Dick. I needed more money at the time, and I knew I was writing as much as I could and still try to maintain a certain level of quality. So that ended up with me going to work for Shooter, and the first assignment was Daredevil, and it was Frank Miller art and Roger McKenzie stories. And the book sales were going up. He was always an also-ran character, kind of a bargain basement Batman. So I got, there was a falling out between artist and writer. Somebody was causing the book to be a success. I guessed it was the artist. So I ruled in favor of Frank and promised Roger that I would give him plenty of assignments. And Frank and I became kind of pals. We lived around the corner from each other when Frank left town, my son apartment sat for him. As I was saying downstairs, Frank was the only person that I have ever been able to talk shop with. We took long walks through Greenwich Village, and we talked about the story we were working on. How is this going to work? What problems do we have to solve? So that was a real collaboration. With Neil, I wrote a script. It went away, and there was a comic book 6 months later. Well, and with Neil, 6 weeks later. But Frank was really interested in the craft. And he started reading. And then Mike Barr and I took him to his first martial arts movie, Broadway and 47th Street. And he was transformed. And then started reading Japanese comics and got into the Asian stuff. Eventually went to Japan and became Frank Miller. Then for a few years, he wasn't speaking to me. I took over Daredevil from him just as a temporary thing to fill in. You know, we had to have somebody write the thing, and there was no logical candidate. But I saw Frank 2 weeks ago. We're pals again, distant pals. We used to have dinner once a month. And if we found ourselves in the same city at the same time, we would take long walks and talk about story problems. As Klaus Janson said, he is enormously talented. But he kept his focus not on I'm getting famous, but on the stories he wanted to tell. That is the X factor. You have to want to tell stories. You have to have a genetic need, I sometimes think, to tell stories. And the people who get good at it, who stay at it long enough to get good at it, want to tell stories. They don't necessarily want to become famous writers. If you start to think that way, the work becomes about you and your contribution. No, it should never be about that. It should be about the story. So with Batman, I could tell spook stories, I could tell detective stories, I could tell superhero stories. Very little that you couldn't do. As I said, I put a stupid science fiction and sex and romance off limits. And if somebody came up with a brilliant story about Batman killing somebody, I might have published it. But nobody ever came up with anything that I thought, this has got to be the biggest honking deal there is when Batman kills somebody. Here's one of the differences between the current Batman guys and my merry men, whom I still see constantly, even though we live in different corners of the country. But we did a number of those long continuities. One of the longest of them was 2,200 pages. But this is how they came about. Somebody came in to me with a really good story idea that needed a lot of pages to tell. And the story idea always came first. I think now they decide, I'm going to do a 1,500-page story and then start worrying about what story to tell. With us, Jordan came up with the earthquake idea. It was the last big idea we worked on. And I wasn't sure. We told Paul Levitz on the January 3rd of next year, we are quitting. All four of us are quitting. So this gives you a year to, you know, find people. Jordan came in after spending a long weekend by himself with the earthquake idea. Well, at this point, we'd been working together for 10 years. We knew we could do Batman stories. We could go on automatic pilot and do stories that nobody would find bad. But if we took Jordan's earthquake idea, we would be moving into territory we had never explored, and we would be working our asses off. And we decided that's the reason to do this. We can just fake it for the next year and be kind of bored, or we can do something we're not sure we can bring off. And 11 issues into it, I realized there is a basic flaw in this plot, and it's my fault for not catching it. The story ran out of energy with the 11th issue. So the 12th issue would have been tying up loose ends. Pretty boring stuff. But it wasn't too late, so I called Devin Grayson and Greg Rucka, explained the problem, explained how I would solve it if I were writing the stuff. But as I always did, if you have a better idea than mine, we'll go with yours. That was the best month of the year. I mean, they collaborated, one in California and one in Brooklyn, and did me a great story in about 5 days. So, as my son learned when he directed movies, half of it is casting. He had David Schwimmer playing a kind of goofy doctor in the show he did for HBO. Schwimmer was very good for that part, and that did half of Larry's directing, the part that had to do with acting. The actor was really good at doing it. There was a woman that nobody had heard of who came in to read for the leading lady. This was a story about the two guys who invented breast implants. And Emily Proctor, who had had one line in one movie, came in. HBO wanted to cast a name, and Larry fought for Emily. I've seen Emily's screen test, and yeah, I mean, she really nailed the part. But he felt that she was so good at the audition, it would be a terrible waste not to give her the part. So he cast a couple of other names. People who came in and worked for one day had one scene. And it was an interesting thing for him to have done. The movie was generally well received and got one atrocious pan by my favorite critic. Talk about mixed feelings. This is my son's movie, and my favorite writer hates it.
Let me open it up to questions from the audience. So who's got... Okay, Batman shirt guy.
First of all, you mentioned Daredevil. I loved your run on Daredevil back in the day. The question I was going to ask, ironically, is about the character The Question that you wrote in the 80s.
So what's the question about The Question?
It's about your time writing The Question.
What was your time like working on The Question? That was with Dennis Cowan?
Yep.
Yeah, it was the best time I ever had making money with writing. Paul Levitz wanted me to start writing. I'd been just functioning as an editor for six months. Paul said, "You got to start writing again." Choices were Captain Atom, who is just a version of Superman, and I've always had problems with God characters. And The Question was a human scale character, but wow, his politics were savagely wrong. And I told Paul, I cannot possibly keep my conscience intact and write this. So he said, write what you want. So I was given carte blanche. I mean, I knew there were certain things that were off limits, though there is one shot of The Question's girlfriend topless. That was Dennis Cowan. I'm not a prude. I think I can prove that if you look at my life. But it was wrong for the story. It didn't mean anything to the narrative. And you never, I mean, John Truby, who teaches screenwriting at UCLA, you never waste a scene. If the scene has nothing to do with the plot, you don't write the scene. So the guy who wrote Death of a Salesman, Arthur Miller, had on a 3x5 cord above his typewriter what the play was about, to remind himself not to stray off point. So I just had a great time. And in the middle of that, I re-met the woman I dated for 4 years in college and high school and didn't see for 30. Her parents broke us up because I was good at two things, writing and acting, and there's no future in writing or acting. You're not going to get good grandchildren that way. So we re-met, and I sent her what had been published about of the question, thinking, if she likes this, we may get back together. If she doesn't like this, it's going to be hopeless. She loved it, so we were married for 30 years, very happily. Anyway, I hope that answers your question.
I'll just go over here to the yellow shirt guy.
Hi. Just a question about Asriel and how you approach that character versus your Batman character.
A question is about Asriel and comparing him
for
to
For some
Batman.
Reason, I was able to hear him.
Okay. This is for the audience.
These are brand new hearing aids, and I don't know how to make them work yet. Asriel was a peculiar one. We knew we were going to do a year of Batman not being on stage. There's another story to tell about that. Anyway, because I was in charge of this entire very complicated year-long storyline, we knew we had to have a substitute Batman, and it fell to me as the one guy who was familiar with all aspects to create him. So I decided I would find out who Bat's natural enemies were. And I did some research, and I found out that we are Bat's natural enemies. Human beings are the natural enemy of Bat. So what was I going to do? Who do Man-Man instead of Bat? So I was thumbing through Funk and Wagnall's Dictionary of Mythology, and the word Asriel struck me. And I read the material on it and thought, an evil angel, that's pretty good. I mean, that's not a bad place to start. So we started to craft the stories to lead up to that. If I had been able to tell you guys, the audience, that this character that we have just created was going to be the new Batman, we would have sold many copies. We did okay, but I thought if I do that, the marketing department will love me, but it'll kind of ruin the story that we're eventually going to tell. So that book has never been out of print, and this has a happy ending. As far as the other part of the Asriel story, we knew we were going to do this, and we knew we were going to take Batman off stage. We were at a retreat. I always tried to get once or twice a year everybody together away from New York. But I knew we were taking a chance with this. So either Scott Peterson or I called New York every 90 minutes and said, we want to emphasize that Batman will not be on stage for a year. At the end of the year, nobody will know anything had changed. And they kept saying, yeah, sure, do it. So 3 months into the continuity, I am crossing a lobby in Midtown Manhattan, and an executive stops me and says, you're killing Batman. And we told you guys, why didn't you listen to us? So we had to come up with that plot in which Bruce Wayne pretends to be Sherlock Holmes. I thought that, I wrote it, but I thought it really weakened the story that we were trying to tell. Martha Thomas's was our PR person who figured out a really interesting way to publicize that, which involved me talking to a classroom full of kids, and mostly high school kids. That was the day that O.J. Simpson and the white Bronco dominated the news. So Martha did a good job of inviting reporters and TV people, and we got very little publicity.
Well, let me open it up to one. I think we have time for one more question, maybe two. I'm going to go to the back. Anybody at the back? Okay, over here. Yes, sir. Sorry, can you speak up? I couldn't hear your question.
Yeah, if you couldn't hear it.
I'm sorry. It wasn't what you were saying. It literally, your register is so low up here, we can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Do you find, corporate, effects, the creations of, characters and stories?
Oh, okay. Do you feel that the company, the corporation, is affecting the kinds of stories that you are telling?
In general.
If you've read Jerry Jones' book, his history of comics, he gets into that a lot. They didn't care. They didn't know. I worked on the Batman franchise for 15 years. Three times in 15 years, I heard from an executive. And the story I just told about having to change a storyline in midstream was the worst of the three times. I know people who work in television and they get rewritten to death. The last live-action television show I wrote was a Superboy, and top of Act 2, he's talking funny. There is no reason in the script or the story for him to talk funny. The reason was the actor wanted to do it, and they let him. That's the kind of nonsense you put up with in television. Comics are a day at the beach by comparison.
So we do have, I think, quite a time for one more. Yes, sir. Yeah?
Yeah.
You started telling us about the biography of Bruce Wayne, you said he was 33, and then we went off topic. Do you remember where we were heading with that?
Can you?
The biography of Bruce Wayne. We got kind of off topic. That was my fault. So how would you fill in the biography of Bruce Wayne?
Well, I've never gotten from another writer what I think Bruce should be. I gave up after a while. I mean, in the movies, it's very uneven. He's a tough businessman, and he's a wimp. In the same movie. My Bruce Wayne was the guy who inherited the A&P fortune. He was a billionaire. He was a dilettante. He didn't participate in the business much. But I wrote when he published Show Magazine. I did a couple of stories for him. He was a nice man. A lot of wives, a lot of wasted money. But not very bright. So my Bruce Wayne would buy a brand new Ferrari and dent the front fender within an hour. He would, his love life would be Gotham City full of models who say, yeah, well, I had a date with Bruce and he was not feeling well. He had to take me home at 11. And of course, an hour later, he's on a rooftop. But I didn't think it was psychologically, it wasn't comfortable for me to give him a love life. At the very least, he would be the worst boyfriend in history. And these are the things that are interpretations. My predecessor on the Batman books gave him a love life, and that was not wrong for what he was doing. I was doing something else. Does that answer the question?
I think so. Well, let's all thank. Is that cool? Was that okay?
That was a great answer. Thank you.
We've just been wrapped, so let's all thank Denny O'Neill for his kindness.